Good evening and welcome to the Spring 2015 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various topics related to sustainability. This semester, our series topic is called Issues in Climate Change, and we have expert speakers on policy, energy, nature conservation, and science, all related to climate change. Tonight's speaker is Eric Wahlberg from the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. Eric Wahlberg manages the Climate Services Program at Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. Recent projects include the Climate Smart Land Network and development of climate change adaptation plans for multiple sites in New England. Prior to joining Manomet, Eric was the administrator of the Physical and Environmental Planning Department of the Hampton Roads Planning District Commission in Chesapeake, Virginia. In that capacity, he focused on climate change adaptation in southeastern Virginia and was responsible for the development of the first regional green infrastructure plan in the state. He holds a Master of Planning degree in Urban and Environmental Planning from the University of Virginia, a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science from Old Dominion University, and a Bachelor of Fine Arts degree from Virginia Commonwealth University. Eric is a member of the American Planning Association and the American Institute of Certified Planners. We have about an hour for tonight's presentation, including some time for questions and answers. Tonight, Eric's lecture is entitled Climate Change, Green Infrastructure, and the Interconnected Nature of Everything. Let's welcome Eric to MCLA.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight. You made it through the snow, and you've got to be diehard climate change fans to be here in the coldest, snowiest winter that New England's ever seen, so, you know, my commendation to you for that. I'd really like to make the session tonight interactive. We've got a small group here. This is a great opportunity for question and answer. So as I go along, if there's something that you've got a question about, something that's not clear, raise your hand. We'll talk about it, kind of work through it. And then I've got about half an hour worth of prepared material. We've got about an hour here this evening. And so would like to use the latter part for questions and discussion. So if you've got some sort of big picture observations, I'd ask that you hold those towards that latter part. So before I get started and explain what the title of the talk's about, I'm with the Manomet Center for Conservation Sciences. And a show of hands, who's ever heard of Manomet? Okay, got a few folks. We are Massachusetts-based. Our offices, our headquarters are located in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and that's where I live and work. We've also got an office up in Brunswick, Maine. We've got people located all over the Western Hemisphere working on shorebird conservation issues. So we've got a team that works up in Alaska during the summertime doing original science, trying to understand what the migration patterns are, what the breeding behavior is of a lot of the shorebirds that are part of imperiled populations. So we are a relatively small organization, about 50 people, but a pretty broad reach geographically. In terms of the four main program areas, I run what's called the Climate Services Program. That's the first bullet there, Preparing America for Climate Change. Andy Whitman, who runs our office in Brunswick, Maine, is very much involved in sustainable economies. They do a lot of work with various sectors of the agricultural industry. We have a big grocery certification program that's expanding very rapidly. So a lot of really interesting work going on up in Maine. As I already mentioned, restoring shorebird populations. Stephen Brown is our chief scientist. He's actually located here in New Hampshire and coordinates a hemispheric effort in this regard. Now, there are sort of two pieces to that puzzle. One is the research work. The other is getting communities up to speed on what's necessary to improve habitat for shorebirds throughout the Western Hemisphere. And then finally, reconnecting people to nature. That is an outgrowth of the bird banding program at Manomet. Manomet's got one of the longest periods of record associated with our banding program in Plymouth. Trevor Lloyd Evans, that runs that program, recently got a grant from the National Science Foundation. And they're doing a lot of work using that information that they've collected on how climate change is impacting land bird migration and bringing that into the schools in a program. We're piloting it in Massachusetts first, and it'll expand using internet technology rapidly beyond that. So anyway, that's what Manomet is about. So, what's up with this crazy title that I've got here for my talk? I'm going to start talking about a fairly recently published framework called the Planetary Boundaries Framework, and it's about establishing what the authors call a safe operating space for humanity, and it really gets at the interconnected nature of climate change and a lot of other environmental stressors. So we're going to talk a little bit about that first. I'm going to provide a fairly brief overview of climate science. I find that this is a topic that is very, very difficult for people that are not focused on it 100% full-time to really understand fully. So we're going to go over a little bit of the mechanics of climate science. Then I'm going to talk about two projects that I'm working on. The first is the Climate Smart Land Network. It's engaging large forestry companies throughout North America, helping them prepare for climate change. And then bringing it down to a more regional and local scale, I'll talk about a regional planning effort in southeastern Massachusetts focused on the Taunton River watershed. And there I'll talk about the integration of green infrastructure at a regional and a local scale to help communities adapt to climate change. So, all right. So the Planetary Boundaries Framework. This was published initially 5 years ago in the journal Science. Just within the last month, an update was published, and this graphic is from that update. Now, the framework hasn't changed much, but I'm going to be talking largely about the most recent iteration of this. And the way that this reads, and actually a question came up, we had a student discussion before this, you know, this is obviously an image of planet Earth in the center here, and there's no correspondence between where these wedges are on this graph and the geographic areas underneath. These are global stressors, and the graphic is just meant to show that they are global. So anyway, we've got several different interrelated categories here, and this is all about thinking through what the metrics are associated with these various categories of environmental stressor and kind of where we are, what we know about those boundaries, and the point that I'm really going to try to drive home tonight is that these things are strongly interrelated, and any work that we do in any one of these categories, you need to be cognizant of what the ramifications are for the other categories. And in some cases, you can actually have win-win kind of interaction between them. In other cases, you can have a stacking of detriments or stressors, if you will. But we'll talk about that. But anyway, just to kind of walk you through this, we've got climate change up at the top. And then you've got biosphere integrity, and that's, you know, sort of a mouthful, but really what that's about is biodiversity loss. And one of the things that's new about the most recent iteration of this framework is that they've identified climate change and biosphere integrity as the two stressors that could, in and of themselves, introduce what they call a state change in how the planet functions. And with climate change, that's pretty obvious to most people. If we warm the planet too much, we reach a point where we lose most of the ice at the poles. We have real problems with food supply. Sea levels rise very dramatically. So, they're very, very major impacts on natural systems and human society. So that one, I think, is pretty easy for people to get and understand why that could cause a state change or move us out of the relatively stable climate that's been part and parcel of the Holocene. The last 10,000 years have been relatively stable from a climate perspective, and it's allowed human society to thrive, prosper, and grow tremendously. Probably not as obvious to most people why this biodiversity piece is a critical peg or metric in this. But in fact, intact biological systems have a lot to do with climate regulation. They certainly have a lot to do with food supply. It's really the climate regulation piece that the authors of this framework have focused on. And I'm going to talk some about the role of forests in regulating climate, what the feedbacks are. And so hopefully as we go through this, you'll start to get a better feel for the relationship between the biodiversity piece, the climate change piece, and why those are the two that are the really critical pieces of the puzzle here. Just to walk you around the rest of these novel entities is, again, just a mouthful for pollution. That it's in their paper justify why they've used that title. But essentially, this is all different flavors of air pollution, water pollution, et cetera. Now, this is one of the ones where enough information is not available to really establish a threshold yet, but everybody, you know, acknowledges that this is an important category. Ozone depletion, I'm sure everybody's heard about that in the news. This is one we've actually dealt with successfully, and we've brought down the level of fluorocarbons in the atmosphere to the point where this is largely stabilized. Aerosol loading, another component of air pollution. This is another one where boundaries have not been set at this point. Ocean acidification is a byproduct of putting a lot of greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. This is one where we've got solid metrics. This is still judged to be within the safe range, but moving up towards this blue circle, which would indicate moving into a problem area. The biogeochemical flows is really all about the impact of nitrogen and phosphorus from agriculture. Now, this is one where we're clearly in the red zone, beyond the point of this being a problem. If you've ever seen any maps or graphics that show, for instance, the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico associated with agricultural runoff from the Midwest, this is the type of problem that we're talking about here and major impacts on ocean ecosystems. Fresh water use, that's just drinking water supply, still in the green zone here. Land system change, which is one of the themes that I'm going to deal with. This is conversion of natural forested areas to agricultural land, urban systems, et cetera. And as you can see, that one's in the yellow zone. So anyway, this is very much early days for this sort of science, this sort of thinking about how to manage the planet as a unified system. And I know it's a little bit frustrating that some of the metrics here are not complete, but I think this is an important enough framework that it's worth being aware of and using it to help inform your thinking about any of these discrete issues and starting to think about how they relate to each other. And the three that I'm going to deal with more specifically in my talk tonight are the climate change, the biosphere integrity, and the land system change piece. So let's talk a little bit about the interactions between these. I've already spoken a little bit about the connections between climate change and the biosphere integrity. But there's another aspect of it that I think is very important to understand, and that is if we look back through the history of the planet, looking at paleoclimate, going back very long periods of time, there have been real changes in biodiversity associated with fluctuations in climate. And one of the critical pieces of the puzzle there is that we've had incredible genetic diversity in our biological systems that have allowed for very robust and elastic response of biological systems to fluctuations in climate. Now, we're in a situation now where biodiversity is really under stress from many different directions, if you will. Urbanization is a big part of the problem. Pollution is part of the problem. Overfishing is part of the problem. And so we're already in a situation now where we're starting to draw down the biodiversity. And at the same time, we're ramping up the rate of climate change. So we really do need to think about how these things are interdependent. And if we warm the planet much more, climate change is going to emerge as one of the major stressors on biodiversity. So we really need to think about the interconnections here. We need to think about the role of biological systems in regulating climate. And as we go about setting metrics, boundaries for management of these resources, we need to think about these interactions. Secondly, biosphere integrity and land system change. Again, going back to the idea that things have fluctuated greatly in the past as climate has warmed and cooled over long periods of time. Oftentimes, the response of biological systems to changing climate is to move on the landscape. So, and I'll show you some images of just how different forest types have moved in North America, and very dramatic movement. You know, particular types of pine forest moving all the way from being up near Canada all the way down to the Gulf Coast and then back again. You know, so we don't usually think of forest as kind of marching up and down the East Coast, but in fact, over very long periods of time, they have. So one of the issues that we've got here is that as we fragment natural systems, and this is through building transportation networks, through building cities, largely through converting huge acreage of land to agricultural use, we start to create barriers in that movement. We start, again, to limit that elasticity in natural systems. So again, we need to be cognizant of thinking about those interactions and managing the planet as a whole system. And finally, interactions between climate change and land system change. Now, as we convert land from forest to agriculture to urban systems, it really changes energy dynamics. It changes the extent to which those areas warm on a hot summer day. And very importantly, it changes the behavior of water on the site. And so energy that might have been used in a tropical forest ecosystem to change the state of the water, to change it from liquid water to water vapor, when that land is cleared and used for agriculture, that goes into direct heating of the land. You no longer got that state change in the water that's taking place. So again, important feedbacks between what we have on the landscape and what the impact of increased greenhouse gas levels in the atmosphere is about. So that's a lot. So I'll stop. Any questions on this before I go on? Because from here I'm going to talk some about some of the basic mechanics of climate science. But any questions on this framework? Any thoughts about its utility? Yep. All right. We're going to go on to climate science. All right. I've only got about 10 slides here. This is, I'm sure this, at least some of this stuff you're going to be familiar with, but I think it's really important to have a solid framework for going on, because the latter part of this, I'm going to talk about some approaches to dealing with this problem. So this to me is just absolutely fascinating information. This is going back 400,000 years from the present. This is information gleaned from ice cores drilled in the Antarctic. And this trace that you've got here, starting off, I'll get my laser pointer to work here, is fluctuation in atmospheric CO2 going back through this period of record. All right. And that CO2 level corresponds to this axis over here on the left. The blue trace that I just put up is how temperature is tracked along during that, and that corresponds to the temperature over on the right. So what we've got here is several ice ages and the deglaciation that takes place in between. And so these peaks are the deglaciation and the troughs are the ice ages. So going back 400,000 years. Now, there's some very complicated exchange that takes place of greenhouse gas between the ocean and the atmosphere. So it's not as simple as this just being a one-to-one correspondence between CO2 levels in the atmosphere and temperature. But nonetheless, these things do track along, and there is certainly a cause and effect relationship here between the two. All right, so what I've put up here is where we are today in atmospheric CO2 levels. So you can see this is profoundly different from where we've been over the last 400,000 years and, you know, this sort of regular cycle that we've been in terms of climate fluctuation. Now, if we, you know, sort of a business as usual scenario, continuing to burn greenhouse gases and ramp that up at the rates that we are in the present day, by 2050, we'll be approaching 500 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, which again, you can see just how different this is. Now, we're not yet in a situation where we've seen the atmosphere respond fully, and I'll explain to you why that is. But hopefully this really makes the point for you that we're in a very, very different situation now than the natural fluctuation over the last several cycles of the climate through ice ages. And it's really setting us up for, you know, as in the planetary boundaries framework, I mean, this is one of the drivers that could cause a state change in the planet. I mean, it's that type of magnitude of influence. All right. Unfortunately, we still see in the media that there are some people, it's a shrinking group, there are still some people that just reject the idea that the planet's warming. And we've crossed that bridge. If anybody tells you that, they're either in denial, they just don't want to see it, or they're profoundly confused. Because at this point, we've got multiple lines of evidence that the planet on the whole is warming up. I mean, this slide speaks to it. I'm not going to read them off. You can read that for yourself. But you take all these lines of evidence in aggregate, and there's just no doubt the planet's warming up. So we've crossed that bridge scientifically. Done deal. Now, why hadn't the atmosphere warmed up all that much? Now that, and you hear this again, a lot of people really think, this can't be a problem. The atmosphere's not warming up all that much. Well, over the last 20 years, we've got much, much better data about what's happening with temperature increase in the ocean. And there's a network of buoys that's been deployed. These buoys kind of cycle through a depth up at the surface of the ocean, and so do a good job of monitoring heat uptake by the ocean. And thus far, all the additional warming that we've had by pumping greenhouse gas into the atmosphere has been taken up by the oceans. You can see there nearly 94% of that heat gain. And if you think of the ocean as being like a flywheel for the climate system, what we've done is we've started to speed up the rotation of that flywheel, if we will. We're putting more energy into it. And that will certainly come to manifest in atmospheric temperatures. It's already manifesting in changing weather patterns. It's not that we've dodged a bullet or anything by not having the atmospheric temperature go way up. It's just that what we're doing is affecting this flywheel thus far. All right, on a 4 or 5 year basis, the federal government produces sort of an update on the state of the science and state of impacts for the climate in the United States. This was just recently updated. I think the updated document came out like October, November of last year. This is nice current information, and they've done a great job this time of using maps and graphics to explain a lot of the fairly complicated concepts about what's going on. I'm going to run you through a couple of maps that show you measured data for temperature, measured data for precipitation, and then also a couple of maps that speak to projected futures, and those projected futures are all about greenhouse gas levels going forward. Now, this is measured information. The map in the center shows you how temperatures have deviated over the last 20 years as compared to the beginning of the century. So the beginning of the century is the baseline here. And you can see at the high end of the scale, you've got temperature increase in the darkest red of 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. At the low end of the scale here, I don't think we've got any dark blue on the map, but we've got this anomalous cool area in the southeast there. So important regional differences in how temperatures have increased. By and large, you can certainly see that we're getting warmer here in the continental U.S. I'll show you a global map of 2014 coming up here soon that'll give you some idea of how things have changed very recently. But again, the graphs around the perimeter here read a little bit differently. This is broken out by decade, shows you weather for a given decade. This is the U.S. on the whole, and these are the different regions right around the outside. A red bar going up shows that decade was warmer than that average at the beginning of the century. The blue coming down shows it was cooler. So you see important fluctuation and differences over time, important fluctuation and differences by geographic region. All right, now this is a graphic that appeared in the New York Times very recently. If you saw in the news, 2014 is now on the record as being the warmest year the planet has ever experienced, in our measured record. The graphic here along the bottom shows you going back to the beginning of the century and then coming forward. This is a little bit faint, but you can see as compared to the average for the century, cooler here, kind of transitional in the middle, and then this cluster of, we're at the point now where almost every year is up in this record heat category. Now, the map up at the top, I think this is absolutely fascinating because, we're here in New England. They're calling for the coldest air you can possibly imagine this weekend. It snows. I live in Plymouth, just south of Boston. We can't dig out of the snow right now. So, a lot of people look at that and they go, the planet cannot be warming up. Look at what's going on. Well, we're in a very static pattern for the last couple of years. And you can see here this blue shading in the eastern U.S. In 2014, despite the fact that the planet was warmer than it's ever been before, for the eastern U.S., wasn't the case. We were cooler. But if you look at the West Coast, and particularly up, look up into Alaska, and this is the same weather pattern that we've had setting up over the last couple of years. This is just a sharp disconnect between the West Coast and the East Coast, where they're baking, they're in a drought out on the West Coast, all this warm air streaming up into Alaska. And you know, we're just freezing to death here. Well, part of what's going on is as you know, the poles are warming up more rapidly than the areas near the equator. And so that temperature difference is starting to come down. We're starting to see larger excursions in the jet stream. And we're getting into these really static patterns where there's this big loop that's allowing all this cold air to pour down off the North Pole. And that's exactly what we're experiencing right now. So, you know, this is where you really have to think like a scientist in understanding this issue. Is there, you know, just because you know, you're sitting in a particular place and there's more snow than you can imagine out the window and it's colder than usual, you know, this is what you have to look at. It's this big global picture to really understand what's happening to the whole system. So. All right, now this is projected information going forward into the future. This is all based on different greenhouse gas scenarios. The way you know, global models are run is thinking about you know, different possible futures in terms of how much fossil fuel we burn, and what the ramifications are for CO2 levels in the atmosphere. So over here, I'm losing my pointer. Okay, here we go. This upper left, this scenario involves a very sharp drawdown in CO2 emission rates by 2050 on the order of 70%. So if globally. So if we were able to get our policy ducks in a row, you know, have all the countries around the planet agree, okay, we really need to deal with this problem now and sharply draw down CO2 levels. By the end of the century, we would see really fairly minimal warming. And this is, in the estimation of most people in the scientific community, a manageable amount of warming. You know, we can keep our agricultural systems intact, water supply still works, et cetera, et cetera. Down in the lower right, RCP 8.5 here, that is business as usual. That's if we keep you know accelerating fossil fuel use at the same rate that we are now, and we continue that on out to the end of the century. And under that, you know, we're up at the high end of this scale. You know, looking at you know for the most part something on the order of 10 degrees increase in average temperature. So I mean, can you imagine for Massachusetts that means we would have a climate something like South Carolina or Georgia. I mean, you know, we're talking about that stark a change in that short period of time. And this really is not a manageable situation. I mean, at this point, the wheels come off, and I don't think it would be possible to grow enough food for to feed everybody. You know, we're looking at probably major social unrest, mass migration associated with you know, certain areas that don't have enough water, don't have enough resources. All right, now we're switching to precipitation. This is measured data. This reads exactly the same as the map that I showed you on temperature, except that obviously here we're dealing with inches of precipitation, and in this case, percent change is the way the graph reads here. But again, important regional differences. In a big picture sense, the parts of the U.S. that are wet are getting wetter. The parts that are dry are getting drier. This trend is projected to continue going forward regardless of the emissions rates. Certainly the speed with which you know the change has happened, the extent of the change, are dependent on those emissions rates. But and really for the Northeast, and this has, again, everything to do with this crazy weather pattern that we're stuck in right now. This map shows you change in very heavy precipitation events. Now, this is the heaviest 1% of precipitation events over the last 50 years as compared to the average for the century. And you can see for the Northeast, we've had roughly a 70% increase in these very heavy precipitation events. So, you know, we've got this cold air pouring south because of these big deviations in the jet stream. We've got an atmosphere that's loaded with moisture. You know, that as the atmosphere warms up, it can hold more water vapor. And so when it comes down, increasingly, we're getting these very heavy precipitation events. So, you know, what we've got going on out here, not all that unexpected, given what climate science will tell you about impact on weather systems. So, So that's the end of the climate science section. Any questions on that? Yeah.
Some of your screens have showed me significant difference between the North Pole and the South Pole in terms of the
coordinate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How come?
Most of the land mass on the planet is in the northern hemisphere. So you end up with real big differences. Land heats up more rapidly. So you've got this really significant difference in terms of land area warming because of that. And that there you've got ocean circulation patterns in the mix. And if you look at paleoclimate, some of the really interesting shifts that have taken place as the planet has warmed and cooled previously have been changes in those ocean transport currents. And you get some unusual flip-flops that take place between the northern and southern hemisphere, but it's mostly due to the difference in the land area. Okay, so the last two sections here, I'm going to talk in this section a bit about forests and climate change, and I'm going to talk about a project that I'm managing called the Climate Smart Land Network that deals with some of these questions, and then the final section will be on urban green infrastructure. So. I think you've gotten the idea by now that there are these important feedback mechanisms between biological systems and the climate system, and certainly forests are among the most important pieces of that. Tropical forests have a net cooling effect on climate. That's a combination of different factors that you need to think about in any land use and its impact on climate. You need to think about albedo, which is the extent to which a surface either absorbs or reflects light. Snow has very high albedo, reflects almost all light that hits it. Asphalt, on the other hand, is at the other end of the spectrum and absorbs almost all the heat energy that hits it. So anyway, forests have relatively high albedo, but especially in the tropics, that's actually overridden by an effect of what's called latent heat, and that is heat that's used to change water from one state to another. And so it's that evapotranspiration associated with tropical forests that creates the net cooling. And this is why you see a lot of information in the media, a lot of efforts underway to try to limit deforestation in the tropics. And it's because of this very important role that those forests play in carbon sequestration and this regional cooling effect associated with the high moisture content in the forest. And in particular, in that part of the world, if you transition to agriculture, you really start to take away some of those climate benefits. But climate change is creating real stressors on forests, whether they're tropical, temperate, or boreal forests. And so I'm going to walk you through a couple of examples of that and then segue into some discussion about the Climate Smart Land Network and how we're trying to address some of this. How many have heard of the mountain pine beetle? Anybody? Yeah? A few people? Okay. All right. Not something that we've heard a whole lot about on the East Coast unless you pay attention to these issues. But this is a huge deal for the forest out in Western Canada and out in the Western U.S. This map shows you an area of infestation here, and this is obviously up into British Columbia and Canada. This is a zoom in here. This red area shows you areas killed by the mountain pine beetle, and then this photograph is from this portion here, and you can actually see shown in red, this is the extent of beetle-killed forest. Now, mountain pine beetle is naturally occurring. It's part of the ecosystem there. I mean, this cycle has been going on for many, many years, so there's nothing unusual in the fact that you've got this cycle in place, but this has been really a perfect storm of a lot of different human factors in the mix here. Climate change being one of them, that's led to an outbreak that's been absolutely off the charts. I mean, this is just like nothing that anybody has ever seen before. I mean, the magnitude is just huge. To set the stage, there was a lot of fire suppression, so the forest was very dense there. You've got an overstocking, much greater density than naturally occurring situation. You've got a warming climate, which is superimposed then on some shorter-term weather cycles. And so you've got drought going on, you've got temperatures warmer than normal, even in absence of a warming climate. You've got all that exacerbated by a warming climate, and that has expanded the range for the mountain pine beetle. So you've got stressed trees because of the heat and the dryness. You've got this overstocking situation associated with fire suppression, and then you've got climate change in the mix. And it just essentially went off like a bomb. you know, and it's created major problems for the forest products industry in this part of the world. I mean, it's a real underpinning of the economy up in British Columbia. And to illustrate this point that I've been talking about the interrelationship between climate regulation and biological systems, in a normal situation, without this massive outbreak of mountain pine beetle, this forest would serve as a carbon sink. And you can see that's what this plot is here, the control scenario that's without the beetle. You can see down here, this graph with the squares on it, that's with the mountain pine beetle in effect. And so for this period starting in 2000, which the outbreak actually started before that, but it really sort of, you know, really ramped up starting in about 2000, all the way out to 2020, you've had this whole forest ecosystem now switch from being a sink, you know, absorbing carbon dioxide for the atmosphere and helping limit climate change, to being a source. So I think this is just a wonderful example of this interrelationship between biological systems and climate regulation. And it also points to the need for us to think about these factors in managing our forest. And if you take a step back and think about some of the fire suppression measures, now, you know, it's hard to have a crystal ball, but since we've lived through this, I think we know now, lesson learned, that having these massively overstocked forests really set the stage for this problem, you know, against the backdrop of climate change. All right. And another example, now this is much, much different time scale. You know, we're talking about geologic time scales here going back on the order of 18,000 years. But you know, I spoke to this a little bit before, but you can see the different tree species types here, spruce, oak, and pine. You can see here how temperatures fluctuated over this long period of record. And then you can see a lot of this is from pollen records. You know, we know how these forests have shifted. But you can see, again, you know, this idea of elasticity and response in biological systems and the extent to which these different tree species have moved up and down the east coast of the U.S. So you start to get an idea there of just how profoundly climate can affect forest position on the landscape and forest structure. And then to that question of forest structure, now this is aggregated by forest type, and so this is where we are currently over here on the left, and what the projected distribution of forest type would be out to the end of the century under a high emission scenario. And you can see up in the north, this blue, we largely lose spruce fir forest. You can see that the maple beech complex shown here in the olive largely moves up into Canada. And then you've got oak hickory taking over a large part of that center portion. So again, now this is back to the time scale that forest managers have to think about on their land holdings. And we've got this possibility of rapid climate change really, really mixing things up. So I'm going to talk a little bit about then, this is going back to the work that I do at Manamet. And I manage a project that we call the Climate Smart Land Network. This is a membership organization for large forest landowners. Our focus so far has been on the large companies that are in this on a for-profit basis. And our goals are to bring them up to speed on climate change, help them understand how fluctuations in climate have influenced forest in the past, and how they can incorporate some of that information in their management going forward. And really, sort of the method of the madness, if you will, is trying to avoid those kinds of situations that I pointed out for you in that mountain pine beetle example. So what we've been doing is going to these different companies. We meet with them. We go through sort of a Climate Science 101 program. And then we sit down with them, kind of roll up our sleeves, and look at you know, the extent to which they include climate change in their management planning. For the most part, that is little or none thus far. And then we kind of work through their management planning process and how they can integrate thinking about climate with the end goal, trying to make the forest more resilient. So far, we've got about 13 million acres in the U.S. and Canada in the network. Our goal in 4 years, we've been at this for about a year and a half now, is to get 30 million acres This shows you in the U.S., the states where we've got land holdings. Now, it's not to say that we encompass all of these states, but these are the states where we've got some of that acreage distributed. Now, this includes, the system includes Canada as well. I don't have a map of that to show you today. So anyway, as I said, we're really about making these companies conversant on climate. What we're seeing is that once they understand the extent to which this can be a game changer for their businesses, they're really taking this to heart, and I think it's going to become a core value in their management. And we think it's one of the sort of biggest levers that we've got. I mean, we've got tremendous acreage in private forest land in the U.S. and Canada. So this is, I think, one of the ways to sort of rapidly go to scale with bringing people up to speed on managing ecosystems in response to climate. All right. So any questions on that? Yeah.
So what are some of the specific actions that they're doing in terms of management?
Yeah. Well, there's sort of two different categories that we've started to think about in this. One is a lot of the companies in the Northeast are dependent on natural regeneration of the forest. And so in those cases, they can make decisions about what trees are coming back from the seed bank, make decisions about what they harvest when. And, you know, we're asking them to think about those tree species that are naturally regenerating on the site that are projected to be robust under a warming climate. So you can make those types of decisions. Another one of the really important intersections is stressors occurring from invasive species, invasive pests, and I'm drawing a blank on the third category. But anyway, the first two serve as a good example. A warming climate, as I showed you in that example with mountain pine beetle, can certainly create stressors that sort of extend beyond what they would be in absence of that warming. And so we're asking people to be sort of more thorough in the inventorying that they're doing. What we're seeing a lot in the Northeast is sort of a layering of stressors, and they're starting to see some decline in some of their tree species that's not directly attributable to any one stressor, but seems to be sort of a piling on effect. So we're asking people to track that more closely, with the hope being that at least some of those stressors can be managed more successfully and will help to alleviate some of the problem associated with a warming climate and changing precipitation patterns. So, yeah.
So you mentioned that this was a program for profit.
Yeah. Well, initially, we plan on eventually bringing conservation lands into the network, but we're starting with the for-profit sector.
And what about public lands, state forests, national forests?
Fair game as well. We haven't gotten there yet, but we've had at least some preliminary conversations with the Forest Management Agency in Massachusetts, and they're interested. And we've also had some preliminary discussions with the Land Trust Network, and again, they're interested as well. So. Right. Yeah.
I understand that in Colorado, with this pine beetle, there are companies going in and harvesting these dead trees and making wood pellets out of them. Mm-hmm. Is that a good idea or not?
Well, yeah. I mean, you're in a situation there. Once the trees have been killed, you know, the die is cast, and they're going to decay and give up the carbon that they've sequestered. So, yeah, I would say that.
Not at the same rate as something burning wood pellets.
That's true. There are issues there that gets into a very complicated calculus, but if the comparison is between cutting live trees for firewood or using the dead trees, you're definitely better off using the dead trees. And if you combine that with some smart forest management so that you're starting to get rapid regen on those sites where you've gone in and cleared the dead trees, that's probably about the best you can do with a bad situation.
So. Locally, here we have a problem with the ash trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
ash borer.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's a lot of ash trees, and I see no evidence of the ash borer.
Oh, okay.
There may be something else doing it.
Okay.
Nevertheless, we have acres and acres of these ash trees.
Right.
Is the same apply in this region, that those should be cut down?
Now, these are dead trees or ailing trees?
Dead and dying, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, if you're going to make a selection for fuel and you've got a tree recently dead, yeah.
Well, you know, that's been a bit controversy lately, that burning biomass is just as bad as burning fossil fuels.
Well, it all depends on your time horizon, and you can certainly if you look at a particular time increment, something in the order of 50 years, you can certainly make the case that burning wood is not that great if you start to stretch that time horizon out so that you start to capture more of the full regeneration of the forest there. Then it starts to look a lot better. So it's all about time horizon, and you have to ask questions, from a policy perspective, of what time horizon are you operating in, what's your target. So, yeah.
So cutting the forest, those dead forests down, will help the regeneration wood improve.
Yeah, I mean, that will move things along, and if, you're cognizant of a warming climate and what tree species you allow are encouraged to regenerate on that site, I think that's all to the good.
So the nutrient value of those dead trees are not significant for the growing.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't want to absolutely remove everything. There's value to the snags from a wildlife habitat perspective. There's certainly a nutrient value from leaving some of it on the land. So I wouldn't argue that you want to go in and clear everything out. But yeah. Okay, our last topic. Thank you for hanging in there. Again, if you've got any questions, let me know. But how many people have heard of green infrastructure? You've heard this phrase before? Okay. It gets used a lot in a lot of different ways. And so bear with me. I'm going to read you this definition because I think this does a good job of capturing sort of a working definition of green infrastructure that I think is really useful. A network of waterways, wetlands, woodlands, wildlife habitats, and other natural areas that support native species, maintain natural ecological processes, sustain air and water resources, and contribute to health and quality of life. And this is from a publication by Mark Benedict and Ed McMahon. But I think it does a great job of capturing what green infrastructure is about, and this works across many different geographic scales. And I like to think of the work that we're doing with the Climate Smart Land Network is sort of green infrastructure writ large. I mean, we're looking at a continental scale there. But this is something that can be scaled down to a regional scale, like the Boston metro area or Western Massachusetts. It also works at a local scale, and so we're gonna talk about that a little bit. All right, on the left here is land use land cover for the northeastern U.S. in 1900. On the right is 2000. The areas shown in red are urban, lighter colored red, suburban areas around the urban core. But the take-home message here is that we've gone from a situation of having essentially some discrete urban areas there to the point where we've got this corridor that's almost all just linked urban system here. So this is reaching a point where we've got so much land area that has been converted from a natural state to an urban state that this really starts to have regional climate ramifications associated with heat island effects that starts to outstrip what we're doing with CO2 levels. And so, if you're thinking about managing these issues on a regional scale, you've got to think about more than just now. I'm not arguing against drawing down CO2 levels. I mean, we've got to do that. But there are other important sort of physical issues in the mix as well. And this is from a series, this is a problem that's been studied for many years. There's lots of great data out there. But this is just to give you an idea, on a hot summer day, and this could be the Washington, D.C. metro area, could be Philadelphia, works for any of those. And you can see out here in the rural landscape on a warm day, temperature of 85 degrees. You start to come in here to the suburban area, it starts to ramp up. You get up all the way into the downtown area where you've got, lots of paved roofs, paved surfaces, black roofs, et cetera. And you're all the way up to 92 degrees there. And then you can see coming out on the other side on the influence of a park here where you've got a bit of a dip, suburban residential, where it goes back up and back over to rural farmland here. So if you start to think about how we design our urban systems, how we do redevelopment, it makes a very strong argument for the inclusion of natural areas in our urban systems. And this is really one of the very important things that green infrastructure can do, is help to limit this heat island effect. Now, in a situation in the Northeast where we're getting more annual precipitation, and in particular more heavy precipitation. Green infrastructure, riparian buffers, for instance, can also do a wonderful job of helping to limit flash flooding, can help to support good water quality by filtering out pollutants, nutrients, etc. So, you know, many sort of win-win situations of including green infrastructure features in urban design. So as a way to kind of walk you through some of this, I'm going to, my final piece of the puzzle here is to talk a little bit about the Taunton River watershed. Now, are many people familiar with the Taunton? It's in southeastern Massachusetts. It's one of the three main tributary watersheds to Narragansett Bay. Manamet put together a climate change adaptation plan for this area, so what are some of the figures I'm going to show you from that. Now, the Taunton, there are many opportunities there for green infrastructure in that as a region, it's still got a very intact wetlands, intact forest, et cetera. Now, it's got a lot of densely built urban areas as well, but it's an area that is going to grow in population going forward, and there'll be associated urban development. And so there are many important choices to be made about, you know, what you leave intact on the landscape and where new urbanization takes place. In terms of climate change vulnerability, some vulnerability to sea level rise. They've got tremendous problems with freshwater flooding. This is a very flat, sort of pancake flat watershed with a high water table. And so the heavy rainfall events that are becoming more prevalent in the Northeast are really creating a problem with urban flooding. As sea level comes up, this is an unconfined aquifer, so the water table's coming up. And then you've got water balance issues associated with drinking water supply. You've got some sub-watersheds in the headwaters of the watershed that are too dry. You've got other areas that are essentially too wet because of a lot of effluent from sewage treatment facilities further down in the watershed. And then finally, you've got a lot of environmental justice concerns. This is a very poor community for the most part, low educational attainment. And so that really became a focus for us in looking at this, is thinking about what could be done to sort of keep the natural systems intact in this watershed going forward, and how that could help to eliminate real large tax increases to deal with a gray infrastructure approach to dealing with some of the flooding problems. This gives you an idea of what the watershed is like. It's got these sort of low benches along the riparian corridor. You'll see in some of the sea level rise analysis how that plays out, and then some elevation gain moving up away from the water's edge. Now we looked at two reaches of the river. This is a simple bathtub model looking at the influence of sea level rise. The darker red you can see over here is 3 to 4 meters of sea level rise. I'm telling you backwards here. The dark red is 2 meters of sea level rise. The next lighter shade, 2 to 3, and then finally the lightest pink, 3 to 4. The darkest red area are those areas that would be influenced by sea level rise up to 2 meters, which is likely that we're going to get into that range by the end of the century. I mean, that would be very much at the upper end of the projections, but certainly possible. All right, this is going upstream from there. And you know, there's sort of a good news, bad news situation here. And there's not much elevation gain as you go inland here. So you can go a long ways up the Taunton River and you still have influence of sea level rise and potential flooding there. The good news is that it doesn't spread out very far from the river because of that topography that I showed you in the photograph. So we did a couple of different regional green infrastructure maps of this area, if you will. Now, this first one looks at some of the water balance issues. These are some of the sub-watersheds where you've got a deficit and you've got excessive groundwater withdrawal for drinking water use. You've got the areas down in here shown in red that are vulnerable to sea level rise. Now, we also included on this, if you are familiar at all with the South Coast Rail Project, this is a proposed new light rail alignment coming out of Boston. And the reason that we included this is we think that there's a real opportunity here to think about trying to concentrate new urban development around these transit stops. That does all kinds of good things from a greenhouse gas emissions perspective because it creates walkable communities that are dense and concentrated around the transit stops. Obviously creates the opportunity for people to use mass transit so there's less dependency on automobiles. And most importantly, from an environmental planning perspective, I'll show you here. This is the second of the two green infrastructure maps that we put together. These are intact wetland complexes and forest complexes shown in the green and in the hatch. And so if you concentrate most of the development along the rail line, corridor alignment there, it really allows you to move away from the areas that are most valuable from a habitat perspective. And going back here, you can see in these sort of bluish-gray areas, these are all of the areas that are vulnerable to freshwater flooding. So again, going to the notion that this is a very flat watershed with a high water table already in a situation where sea level rise is going to push that water table up and we're getting heavier and more precipitation over time, it's really important that we try to avoid development in those flood-prone areas. So anyway, this hopefully starts to give you an idea of this interplay between lots of different factors and trying to think holistically about management of a region. And you know, I think that this does, in fact, start to roll up into meeting some of the criteria that we've talked about in that planetary boundaries framework. So, you know, it can seem daunting to think about the planet as a unified system, but if you start to think regionally about some of these problems and how those interactions take place, you can actually start to design local and regional planning efforts that adhere to that global boundaries criteria. So, just tell you kind of where we are in the process here. We've got a consortium of includes several federal agencies, EPA, a lot of the state agencies that are involved in natural resource protection are involved, the regional planning agencies that have done a lot of the work on transportation planning and South Coast Rail are in the mix, a couple of universities, and then a number of nonprofits are all part of the consortium. And we're currently applying for grant funding. And we really think we can make this sort of a test case for dealing with smart regional urban planning in the context of a fiscally constrained environment, which, you know, if you can get it to work there, I think it's something that has legs and could work in other parts of the U.S. All right, so just three slides in closing here to think about, what needs to happen to move all this along. And certainly, in the educational heading, it's incumbent on all of us, particularly those people involved in putting curriculums together, to think about teeing up these issues in a way that these interconnections are apparent and people, students, become more conversant in thinking about how these systems interact with each other. I mean, this is really going to be necessary going forward. And I think, unfortunately, it's not very common right now that our educational systems foster this sort of interdisciplinary thinking, but absolutely essential going forward if we're going to get a handle on solving some of these problems. In terms of engagement, this is very much what Manamet's about, and we talk a lot about engaging what we call the massive middle of society. And certainly, if you think of society as a bell curve, you've got people out on one end of it that are already very motivated to work on these problems. But that's not sufficient. We need mainstream society engaged on this. And so that's really what Manamet is about. That's why we take the approach that we do with business and industry. And we think that is one way to help move or motivate the massive middle. And then finally, thinking about local action, for those of you here in your community thinking about, what can I do to get involved in this? Get involved in your local planning processes. The transportation planning process is an important piece. When comprehensive plans are updated, push for the inclusion of green infrastructure solutions there. When your zoning code is updated, that's the way that the comprehensive plan often gets implemented. So there are many, many opportunities at the local level to start to include thinking about some of these large global issues at the local scale. And I think, if we get many, many communities that can do this, it then starts to roll up into a bigger picture solution. So, all right, that's it. All right, be happy to take questions. Yeah.
Are you familiar with the work done at the Harvard Forest on actually measuring the amount of carbon dioxide and oxygen, the CO2 taken up? And
Generally familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah, isn't that exciting?
Yeah, yeah.
I was wondering if you've noticed any studies on, you know, for indoor air quality, for example, we know that maybe 1,200 parts per million in this classroom, for example, might make us all feel drowsy. And we're at 400 parts per million. Is there any studies that are looking at really granular changes in CO2 levels in the atmosphere and how that may be affecting lots of different species besides us?
Yeah. Now, those are notoriously difficult studies to do out in the field. But, yeah, there are people doing them. And they, you know, I've seen pictures of, you know, an apparatus that will either take an area of cropland or an area of forest, and they'll artificially enrich the atmosphere in that area with CO2 and do it, you know, for a long enough period of time so they can start to get some idea of what the ramifications are. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work going on in that area.
How do you rate the typical Massachusetts well? Is it a methane generator? Is it carbon sink?
Man, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I think I'm just going to have to say I don't know the answer to that. Now, you know, wetland systems can, over their life, you know, fluctuate across that spectrum. And I just don't know the answer to what sort of the average, you know, Massachusetts wetland would be. I mean, if I had to guess, I'd say we've probably got a full spectrum there. I just don't know, you know, where most of them would be on that spectrum.
So we've run out of time for this evening. I encourage you, if you want to chat with Eric, he'll be up here for a few minutes. Let's just thank Eric.
Thank you.